This is Statehouse Watch, wishing you the best on Memorial Day.
What will you do when the war is over? Tender comrade, when we lay down our weary guns, when we return home to our wives and families, and look into the eyes of our sons, what will you say of the bond we had? Tender comrade, will you say that we were brave as the shells fell all around us? Oh, that we wept and cried for our mothers and cursed our fathers for forgetting that all men are brothers. Will you say that we were heroes? Or that fear of dying among strangers tore our innocence and false shame away? And from that moment on, deep in my heart I knew that I would only give my life for love. Brothers in arms, in each other's arms, was the only time that I was not afraid. What will you do when the war is over? Tender comrade, when we cast off these khaki clothes and go our separate ways, what will you say of the bond we had? Tender comrade.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all 31 and he's only 70. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA, and he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the walls. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon to the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame, but his orders come from far away. no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end to war.
You are listening to WNHN LP 94.7 FM and streaming live at WNHNFM.org. This is Statehouse Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert from the American Friends Service Committee. Our weekly radio show, broadcast Mondays at 5 p.m. and rebroadcast Tuesdays at 8 a.m., is a companion to our Statehouse Watch newsletter, which comes out every Friday during legislative seasons. To subscribe, go to afsc.org/nh and look for the subscribe button. You'll get the newsletter delivered right to your inbox. We started this week's show with songs from Billy Bragg and Buffy St. Marie. We'll continue with more Memorial Day music, and we'll also feature an interview Maggie Fogarty conducted over the weekend with Representative Chris Schultz, who chairs the House Progressive Caucus. The legislature has been largely out of commission since the second week of March, when the House and Senate held marathon sessions. In recent weeks, some House committees have been meeting over Zoom to consider bills which were already passed once but referred to second committees. Those bills will go to the House floor on June 11, when the nearly 400 members plan to meet in the Whittemore Arena at UNH in Durham to allow them to be adequately distanced. They'll also get some new electronic gizmos to cast their votes. The public will be able to watch or listen in electronically. The Senate has been quiet, but is also expected to meet in the second week of June in Representatives Hall, where the 24 members can spread out safely. What we've heard is that legislative leaders have agreed they will focus only on bills relevant to the coronavirus pandemic, with everything else they've been working on to be put aside. We're hoping that means attention to reestablishing and raising the minimum wage, a change that will help workers at the low end of the wage scale, many of whom we now recognize as essential. We're also looking forward to passage of paid family medical leave for all workers, and we'll be watching to see whether Governor Sununu vetoes these measures, as he did last year, before the pandemic gave us new appreciation for workers we all depend on. We've heard bills might be combined into omnibus packages, and that there might be rule changes to allow for new bills to be introduced. I don't know how that will work, but when we find out, we'll let you know right here on Statehouse Watch. We're also hoping for legislative changes to make sure we can vote this fall, even if it's not safe to show up at normal polling locations. We'll discuss voting with Olivia Zink after our next song. This is Statehouse Watch on WNHN LP. When John Prine finished service in the U.S. Army, he took a job as a mail carrier in Chicago and thought up songs while he walked his route. Here's one of them from his 1971 debut album.
While digesting Reader's Digest in the back of a dirty bookstore, a plastic flag with gum on the back fell out on the floor. Well, I picked it up and I ran outside, slapped it on my window shield. And if I could see old Betsy Ross, I'd tell her how good I feel. But your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. They're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. And your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. Well, I went to the bank this morning and the cashier said to me, if you join the Christmas club, we'll give you 10 of them flags for free. Well, I didn't mess around a bit. I took him up on what he said and I stuck them stickers all over my car and one on my wife's forehead. But your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. They're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. Into heaven anymore. doctor down, I was already dead. And I'll never understand why the man standing in the pearly gates said, but your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. We're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. And your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore.
I'm Arnie Alpert in the Zoom studio for State House Watch, and I am joined by Olivia Zink, the Executive Director of Open Democracy. Welcome back to State House Watch, Olivia.
Thanks for having me, Arnie.
Olivia, one of the things that's gone on since this crisis hit is that Secretary of State William Gardner has established a select committee to look at reforms or changes that are needed in order for our voting system to work at a time when, for many of us, we consider it unsafe to show up at our town halls to register or to vote. And in fact, many of our city and town halls aren't even open. Tell us a little bit about this select committee, what's going on, and what your message to them has been.
Voting and our elections are such a fundamental part of our democracy. And since COVID-19 hit, everything's changed. We've learned how to do remote work. There's been so many changes and adaptations that it's really important that we adapt to ensure that our democracy is strong during the COVID-19 crisis. In other states like Wisconsin, we saw devastating effects. Early on in April 10th, the Secretary of State and the Attorney General issued guidance. This guidance expanded the definition of disability so that anyone can cast an absentee ballot.
Olivia, this is interesting because there's been so much attention to the danger of voter fraud. And now, in effect, Bill Gardner and the Attorney General are telling us that we can just say we're disabled, even if by any common understanding of that word, we're not. And we're supposed to file a form under penalty of violating voter fraud laws that says that we're disabled in order to qualify for absentee ballot. Is that an accurate read?
That is an accurate read. And the Secretary of State's Emergency Committee, one of the things I advocated for was adding COVID-19 as a checkbox. And it sounds like we actually might get a COVID-19 checkbox, so you don't have to check disability. It was a big concern I had that people would be confused or not want to sign that they're disabled. But I think the most important thing is when we have these stay-at-home orders to protect the public health, voting from home is something that we all need to do and we all need to figure out how to do.
What are the other changes that are needed for the voting system to adapt not only to the pandemic, but to the reality of modern life?
I think there's a lot that needs to change within our voting systems. We have a lot of rules that require a lot of things to be done in person, such as registering to vote. There has been an executive order 43 that allows you to register to vote by mail with COVID-19 as an excuse, but you still need to have these forms witnessed. And so I think it's really important as we think about how to change a system that is mostly done by going to a polling place into a new COVID-19 reality. And everything has to change. The number of booths in order to do social distancing, all of that is in statute. So Arnie, there's about 150 things that need to change, whether by statute or by changing the procedures in order to make all of this work.
Well, Olivia, Open Democracy was already advocating no excuses absentee voting as an important reform. Is that something that the Secretary of State could just put into place if he wanted to, or does it require legislation to be passed and signed by the governor?
There has been a piece of no excuse absentee legislation. It has passed. The governor vetoed it last year. It has passed the House again this year. No excuse absentee ballot, I see as something that does need a legislative change in order for us to move to no excuse absentee. We will see if no excuse absentee makes it over the finish lines, but there's a lot of other reforms like online voter registration that are needed for certain crises. I do want to answer the first question. This select committee was put in place after the federal government passed the CARES Act, and the first CARES Act provided funding to New Hampshire. So this is $3.2 million of federal dollars that has to be matched at the state level. And in order to spend spend that $3.2 million, the Secretary of State, through the HABA funds, creates a select committee to make recommendations on how to spend the money. This select committee was appointed in April and got to work. It has 6 members, 3 Republicans, 3 Democrats. They have been working 3 days a week. I have had the privilege of listening to hours of meetings, hearing testimony from town clerks and selectmen and all the poll workers, from public health officials, from advocacy groups, from colleges and universities, all of which outlining problems and solutions that we can address for the COVID-19. The first few of these meetings were very sobering. All of the logistical hurdles that are needed in order to make elections safe and secure. And I think as the select committee is pivoting from hearing testimony and determining problems and looking for advice on solutions, they have the tough job to do. How do they allocate this $3.2 million? When we think about $3.2 million, we think that's a lot of money. But it's really like $3.20 a voter. When you think about what's needed for masks and gloves, other provisions to keep poll worker safety, the PPE that's needed, what's needed for printing and the time it takes to process an absentee ballot. I learned from clerks that it's 20 to 30 minutes per ballot. The scale and scope of this is very resource intensive. And I think we really need to sort of think about, are there ways we can streamline the process? Are there ways where we can spend our money efficiently? And will there be a need for more than $3.2 million to ensure that we have secure elections? And there is some talk that there might be some additional funding moving from Congress, but it might be something that the state needs to pay for out of their existing Help America Vote funds in order to ensure that we have a safe election this cycle.
Right. Olivia, for example, we might think about something like having town clerks mail absentee ballot applications to every registered voter. Well, that would cost a lot of money. For that matter, it might also be good for the postal system. So that seems like a win-win from my perspective. But I've also heard about having the responses be in postpaid envelopes so that we're not enacting, in effect, a new poll tax in which people have to pay in order to have the right to vote safely.
And on Thursday, the select committee voted to take prepaid postage return off the table. They did get a lot of backlash from that vote on Thursday. I am hearing that there might be a motion to reconsider on Tuesday. Things are moving. There's a lot of great ideas. And ultimately, this committee is going to make a recommendation. This recommendation that they make, Secretary of State can choose to spend the money based on those recommendations, or the Secretary of State can choose to make his own decisions. And I think that's the thing that's most scary to me in this whole process.
Olivia, before we go on to talk about the legislative fixes, how do people find out when the Secretary of State Select Committee meetings are taking place if they want to listen in?
They can go to the Secretary of State's website, sos.nh.gov. The Secretary of State Select Committee on Elections is meeting this Tuesday, May 26th at 11 o'clock, Wednesday, May 27th at 2 p.m., and Thursday, May 28th at 11:30 a.m. These will be work sessions to make recommendations on how to spend the $3.2 million to ensure that we have safe elections this fall.
Well, that's something we certainly all can get behind. I'm Arnie Alpert. You are listening to State House Watch. We're with Olivia Zink from Open Democracy in our Zoom studio today. Olivia, I'm curious, the legislature is coming back, the House on June 11, the Senate maybe at the same time, but we're not yet sure. What are you hoping they will do in order to enact legislation that will make voting fair, accessible for everybody?
I'm hearing that there's a robust COVID-19 voting package that will make adjustments to the process on absentee ballots, the forms that are needed, some changes to the registration to make it for COVID-19, ability to register to vote by mail, and other changes to the in-person voting process. So when you go to vote in person, You will have socially distanced polling place, the appropriate PPE for election officials, and other changes that are needed in order to ensure that we have secure and safe elections this fall.
Well, certainly we can't allow democracy to become a casualty of this pandemic. Olivia Zink, how can people stay in touch with Open Democracy and find out about your comprehensive agenda this year?
Great. You can visit opendemocracynh.org/absentee. There's a lot of good resources on how to cast your vote absentee and what are the processes needed to do that, as well as you can join one of our action teams that are meeting weekly to get updates on what is moving forward and how to advocate with your town clerk and communicate and educate voters on the new processes. So you can join one of those action teams by going to opendemocracyaction.org.
Olivia Zink, thanks for being with us on State House Watch.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You are listening to State House Watch on WNHNLP on Memorial Day. This is Nina Simone.
Mr. Backlash, Mr. Backlash, just who do you think I am? You raise my taxes, freeze my wages, and send my son to Vietnam. You give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools? Mr. Backlash, I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blues. Earn a little cash. All you got to offer is your mean old white backlash. But the world is big, big and bright and round, and it's full of folks like me who are black, yellow, beige, and brown. Mr. Backlash, I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue. Mr. Backlash, just what do you think I got to lose? I'm gonna leave you with the backlash blues. You're the one who'll have the blues, not me. Just wait and see.
You are listening to State House Watch Radio. I'm Maggie Fogarty with the American Friends Service Committee, and I am in our Zoom studio once again this week, and this time with our friend and colleague, Representative Chris Schultz from Concord. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me back.
Yes, I think, is it correct that you helped us in the early shows of this legislative season, which now seems like a lifetime ago? Were you one of our early guests this year?
It does feel like a lifetime ago, yes. Thank you.
Yeah, and you were describing the exciting priorities of the House Progressive Caucus at near the beginning of the session, and things for circumstances beyond any of our control. Things are taking a turn. So thank you for agreeing to be with me. We want to look at the process for how the House of Representatives plans to insert itself into the urgent work of helping New Hampshire respond to the coronavirus crisis. And that requires a whole lot of changes and adaptation. So please give us whatever insights you have from leadership, from the caucus, from fellow House members about what we can expect in the weeks to come. And then I'd love to talk about how you think the state of New Hampshire is doing in its initial phases, and what the priorities would be of the House Progressive Caucus, of which you are chair. So process-wise, tell us what you're hearing. What can we expect? We know there's a House session scheduled for June 11th, but that's about it.
So far, the only business that the House has had are what we call second committee bills. These are bills that we've already passed in one committee and on the House floor, and then have been deemed necessary to go to another committee. So I think there are about 30, maybe somewhere between 30 and 40 of those. So while it took us a while to get going because of a lot of mixed interpretations of our, let's face it, our rules were better for like the 1830s than for now. So, you know, it's been interesting. So, and, you know, a piece of this is a good thing. You know, of course, nothing about COVID has been good, but the piece that wants to make sure that people are included, that no one who wants to access these meetings are excluded, and that the process that we chose for the having hearings has been a good one. And so it's been interesting to see that our House leadership signed a contract with Zoom, the company, to do this. And I think it's worked fairly well. Certainly makes a case for what I know to be a good progressive value that we need broadband access in every nook and corner of this state. That is a bill that I believe the Senate is taking up and we hope heads to the House. We also need to give technology to those who can't afford it so that they can work from home or so their children can access learning during these strange times.
Absolutely. But,
Our committees have been good. I mean, my committee had four bills that we took up. Those moved forward. And so on
Say again what your committee is.
Oh, thank you. The Executive Department's Administration Committee. So we deal with things. We deal with a number of things. It's a long
And what your committee has held so far are, as you say, executive sessions, right? Have you had any public hearings yet?
No, it's at in our rules, the discretion of the chair, if we receive any second committee bills, whether or not we need to have a hearing. It has been the practice in the short time I've been a rep, that we do have those hearings so we can have folks do their presentations and the bill sponsors can tell us the purpose behind the bill and we can ask questions, et cetera. But the chair at his discretion of our committee, and I think this is true of almost all committees, if not completely all the committees, that the chairs have used their discretion on these second committee bills to waive a hearing.
Okay.
So partially because it was another logistical hurdle that they were able to exclude. So on June 11th, we will be acting upon those second committee bills, and I'm excited. I guess we'll be the first big gathering officially allowed by the state of more than 10 people as a state legislature. So I'm excited that we are meeting
at the Whittemore Center, right?
Yes.
Where there's ample room for sufficient physical distancing, right? And I understand an electronic voting system is being arranged so that mechanism carries over.
And what's interesting to me is someone who is, I'm immunocompromised. And I, you know, I want to do my job as a rep, obviously. And I'm excited about what, you know, to handle the challenges that face us, as well as play our role at a time when the governor, I feel, has taken a lot more leeway during these times than he needed to, that we can play our role. That it's in a hockey arena is really helpful for those who've been protesting at these, I've been calling them the chicken pox parties. You know, the folks that have wanted to not wear masks and have some sort of a protest going on, that we're in a hockey arena where there's lots of plexiglass protection for pucks for hockey, that will also serve a dual purpose, protecting those of us who very much want to protect ourselves, as well as wear masks in case any of us are transmitting without any known symptoms, that we can be better protected. So that is...
Will people be temperature checked on their way in as well?
Yes. Of course, that doesn't determine whether or not someone is transmitting it, but
That's right. But it's something. Right?
Yeah. And I've talked to the folks who are thinking this through, and they really are trying to think of every possible avenue. You know, there's a lot of pressure on us because there's so many of us, but also because we're the oldest by average age of all the state legislatures in the country. So not only are we the biggest.
With an average age of 63, is that?
Yeah. Correct? Yeah, which has gone down. It used to be a lot higher.
You probably helped to lower that a little bit.
Yay. I'm definitely in the younger crowd, which I find interesting.
But let me ask you, so it sounds like the primary agenda for June 11th, other than, I mean, you know, watching to see is this system going to work. So it's in some ways, it's an official session, but it also feels a little bit like a test run, like, okay, how do we do this? Because it might be needed in 2021 as well. But that the primary agenda is to deal with House bills that have completed their work in the second committee and will have some kind of committee ruling from that executive session. Will the House also be dealing with bills that the Senate completed work on several weeks ago, back in early to mid-March, or is that going to be further delayed?
I have heard nothing at all about the Senate sending us any bills at this point, which is a concern.
Sure.
I would encourage anybody listening to this to call their state senators and urge that business to move to the House. At the time we last met, which was in our big marathon overnight session at the beginning of March, the Senate still had, I don't know, something like 40 or 70. It was quite a large number of bills that they still needed to act upon before they were going to send any bills to us anyway. But and that included they needed to have the hearings and go through that whole process.
Well, let's talk about the more... Oh, sorry, I don't want to cut you off.
No, that's okay. I can just keep talking, but you're good to interrupt me.
Well, no, you're saying important things. So I have a more macro question. We started this session with many hundreds of bills, and some of them have died their natural death, but many hundreds are still alive and are either halfway through the process or three quarters of the way through the process. It does not seem, if it's true that we've heard that the House anticipates two or three full sessions in order to wrap up its business for 2020, it does not seem possible that they could meaningfully deal with that many pieces of legislation. I don't know if the Zoom capacity even exists for all the public hearings that would need to happen, additional full sessions, et cetera. So can you just talk about what is the process being proposed for dealing with the bulk of the work that was initiated this session?
Well, I genuinely have no idea yet how the Senate bills will be handled at all, other than knowing that the Senate will be using the House chambers, which they're welcome to do. Yay, Senate, welcome to the House. Other than that, the main thing I've heard is that there's a lot of pressure from the Senate to, I don't know what the right word is, condense and capsulize the business that they have remaining. So I don't think we have fully heard what they want to do. Of course, they're under a whole other set of rules. It's hard for me to know.
They could table a whole bunch of House bills that they receive from you all. They could combine some. Is that what
yes.
you're saying?
I'm hearing that that is what we should be expecting. I'm hearing that they are looking for any way, shape, and form to reduce the workload. I'm also not hearing anything concrete yet, and hopefully that yet is a good thing, that I don't know of any legislation that we will be facing regarding COVID, other than a few bills that just by happenstance happen to fit nicely into that approach.
Do you mean new bills, or do you mean, say yes. more about that. Do you mean looking at the current bills that were initiated this year already that now have extra importance because of COVID, or do you mean new legislation that crafts a policy or funding response?
Well, I definitely haven't heard anything new or any sort of plan from anyone yet about new legislation. We as the Progressive Caucus are putting together some priorities that we hope folks will take a look at, that we'll look at it from a number of approaches. But right now, the main thing we're hearing is, to me, it feels like a pressure to reduce the 400 or so bills the House has passed already and that should be on their way to the Senate, that we should look towards reducing that to a very small list and assume everything else is going to die. And that creates a lot of problems. The expectation is this will trend conservative. It will not look at a lot of major priorities to us as progressives, to things that would look at what we know to be true, that there already was a large segment and is a large segment of our society that were already on the margins, too many people on the fringes of our society and low-income jobs. You know, it's nice that folks are lifting up a number of these jobs in a way with dignity and gratitude. Many, you and I, and many, probably anybody listening to this is already there. You know, labor has dignity. And
but part of that dignity is protections, paid leave,
yes,
living wages. So when I was a waitress, we always said, we don't, you know, thanks for the compliment, but I don't just need a verbal tip. Put some cash in the jar.
Right.
And I think we can wear buttons supporting our essential workers or put signs in our yards. But if we're not matching that with living wages and good benefits, then it really doesn't seem true.
Absolutely.
This is State House Watch on WNHN-LP. We'll be back with part two of Maggie's interview with Chris Schultz after another song for Memorial Day, this one from Phil Oakes.
Sailors and soldiers, uniform shoulders, they're growing older over the sea. Troops they are leaving, firmly believing there's no reason for grieving over the sea. Herded like cattle, they head for the battle. The rifles will rattle over the sea. Far from the banner, far from the glamour, far from the planner who sent them to die. Sailors and soldiers, uniform shoulders, they're growing older over the sea. Too young to be shaving, but the flags are waving for the fury they're braving over the sea. Proudly parading with medals they're laden, but their glory is fading over the sea. Far from the banner, far from the glamour, far from the planner who sent them to die. Sailors and soldiers, uniform shoulders, they're growing older over the sea. Troops they are leaving, troops they are leaving.
Here's part two of Maggie's interview with Representative Chris Schultz.
I want to hear what your thoughts are about how you had mentioned earlier the governor's really expansive authority that he is acting from so far during this crisis. And part of that relates to the House not having been able, as a body of 400 with some older practices, not being able to insert itself right off the bat. But so the fact is that the leadership for the response so far has been from the executive branch. How would you characterize what you've seen happen already, the prioritization for funding,
the
various protocols?
Well, I think the good news is many of us have been pleased that, and let's admit it, compared to the president, the bar is low, but many of us have been pleased that a number of areas that we expected the governor to take a more political stance, he's actually done a fairly decent job, but again, the bar is low. the fact that he has used this executive order process to bypass, co-opt the work of both the executive council and the legislature, but especially the legislature. As I understand it, and this isn't in the news, but there still is a court case that's ongoing, you know?
Oh, yes. Yeah, there is. There just wasn't any developments this week, as far as I know.
Right. And, you know, it is difficult. We want to have, all of us, I believe, want to have a swift response where that's needed, where it's necessary. And certainly in far too many areas, especially at the beginning, those maneuvering of government was too slow to call us, you know, a stay-at-home order. There still has not been a wearing masks order. I don't know what you officially call that, but everybody should be wearing a mask when they're in a public area.
Right. Instead of relying on kind of a business by business approach, or relying on just kind of conscientious citizenry, which I think people have shown themselves to be conscientious, but that's not a strong enough response, really. It doesn't give
people protection. And since every state in the country has some form of a return to business as normal order, that seems to be a complacency that I see far too many people taking. You know, I live in an apartment complex, and I see very few people out in the common areas wearing a mask. Very few people. Right. There is a time every weekday that kids receive their free or reduced lunches from our school system. No one wears a mask. It's a melee. Everybody runs up to the bus as a big group, like everything's normal. And we have a multi-generational living situation here. There is at least one baby in my section of a building, and my next door neighbor is 103 years old. So
my goodness, wow.
Yes, we have a range, but that also creates a lot of complications that when people
I hope the people delivering the food are masked, are they?
No.
Oh my goodness.
No one is. And it's just very lackadaisical. And I'm trying to do some subtle pushback and not make it a big to do yet, but you know, I'm tempted to film it and put it on the internet and
yeah, you know, or at least say to the person driving the bus, like, you'll set a very good example for, you know, these neighbors if you show up yourselves wearing masks and take a moment to explain why you are and why we would all benefit. One of the observations we've had about the executive response so far is that there are certain groups of people who aren't really well represented at the various tables that the governor has. You know, the advisory boards, the reopening, the stakeholders, and it's specifically, you know, people with disabilities, people who are renters, people of color, immigrant community members, frontline workers. So there might be people there intending to speak for them, but I don't think that anybody can say that they're well represented.
Exactly. And I don't know that, you know, entire chunks of our society have not been represented at all.
Right.
Our state has oftentimes, regardless of party, put small business interests forward, which is a good thing, and business in general, without also looking at or listening to people who work at these businesses.
That's
what good is it to ask even owners of a golf course how they feel about opening if none of the caddies or folks who check people in or folks at the, you know, if they have a clubhouse restaurant, how those workers feel about it. In every industry that I know, with maybe a few exceptions for healthcare, no industry that's been represented has also had a commensurate representation of workers.
That's
a huge problem. And, some of us have raised that with, there's at least, on the return to and the opening of businesses, I forget the exact name of that task force.
The reopening task force?
Yes. A lot of us have been working with Ed Butler to try to help push that forward, but, you know, it's not up to him. He's one member of that task force, and he has been a good voice, but we need to raise those voices loudly. And if that is one way, if we are able to do new legislation, that's certainly a progressive priority.
Sure. Yeah, let's talk about that, because you've got some very thoughtful priorities in your caucus. Let me just say first that you are listening to State House Watch Radio on WNHN 94.7 FM in Concord. I'm Maggie Fogarty, and I am in our Zoom studio with State Representative Chris Schultz. So, yes, I didn't mean to cut you off to pivot to this, but why don't you describe for us what some of the priorities are within the
Sure, and we're still developing this, so, and we hope to include any thoughts anybody would like to add to this, but we want to, and we are putting together a list of progressive priorities to consider both with the bills that are moving forward, because there is a lot of pressure to chuck progressive priorities. We definitely want to make sure the $15 an hour minimum wage bill isn't set to the side. We definitely want to make sure that a lot of the criminal justice reform bills that are, I believe, are not on making it onto the right list right now that folks have worked so hard on. A number of our priorities might be shoved to the side just for simplicity's sake. And that is the wrong reason to shove it to the side. So we definitely are going to need help in advocating for those bills. Also,
is the bill to raise the wage on the likely to move forward?
The $12 an hour bill is likely to move forward, but the momentum we had in the House may not compel the Senate to look upon it favorably, unfortunately. And so we definitely need to be advocating for that bill.
Absolutely. I mean, this goes back to what we were saying about how do you show essential workers that you believe their labor is valuable, for heaven's sake.
Right. It's nice the governor has done a temporary family medical leave process and such, but we would like that to still be permanent, and that bill is also moving forward. And then to pivot now to the bigger priorities that I don't think this is just a progressive priority. I think this is a community value. You know, let's take an easy one, to me at least. The fact that the majority of workers who don't get paid sick leave are people who work with the public and or are food. I mean, even if you are a sociopath, you might want to make sure the people handling your food aren't sick when they make it or give it to you or pick it or however you want to.
Yeah, for heaven's sake, what an example of where our self-interest can lead us to the benefit, doing something good for other people.
Right. I mean, I would think that would be a common sense thing for folks who connect the dots, and maybe they just haven't connected the dots. I mean, obviously we want it because it's the right thing to do, but yeah, I kind of want to make sure the person who's handling my burger doesn't have the flu. But also that goes to the, just in general, making sure folks have hazard pay. If they, you know, are putting their lives at risk at a grocery store or restaurant, we should be protecting them and encouraging and giving the gratitude with our money as much as with, you know, our high fives or whatever, our non-touching fives.
What about bills related to voting access? We've got primary in September, general election November. This will not be done.
Yes. That's another bill that the House passed, is a no excuse absentee ballot bill. This has been something that folks have been, you know, on our side have been pushing for years. It makes sense. And that could become the best bill that we could have, that any one of us who feels unsafe going to a polling location should be able to vote from home. You know, there's such a, and what's interesting from what I understand is from the studies of places that have moved to that process of even just mail-in ballots as a complete process, that hasn't benefited one party over the other. That has benefited the entire state, you know, regardless of party. That's a very much a nonpartisan thing.
It absolutely should be. Yeah.
Yeah. And I happen to also be a poll worker on election day in my polling location, registering voters. That process can take place from home as well. You know, the amount of so-called voter fraud in these situations is extremely, like to a really extreme low situation. I think all the research that happened in the prior process to see where, quote unquote, all these buses and voter fraud things are happening in New Hampshire elicited 2 people, maybe 4 at the most. And extensive research was done by folks at the Attorney General's office and the Secretary of State's office looking to root out and substantiate these claims, have rooted out like nobody, essentially, if you look at it statistically, of wouldn't have swayed any race. And it's barely negligible in the total. So
that's right. Now, when you think of all the things, I register my car, I could have registered for the draft, I pay my taxes. There simply is no excuse to not have online voter registration and absentee ballots. Well, we are running out of time. I wonder if you can tell us what you think the schedule will be for the remaining sessions for House and Senate. Is that just unknowable at this point? Do you expect to be working through the summer? Do you think things will be wrapped up by the 4th of July? Are you going to be back in the fall for something other than veto overrides?
I don't know. I mean, I've heard some preliminary things about a veto override maybe happening in September. Everything is preliminary except for the June 11th session. I would urge folks especially to talk to their state senators one more time. I will ask, you know, for that. I can only speak for the House that our leadership is looking to do our normal business and looking also, I believe, to some at some point taking up new legislation potentially, but it is up in the air. Most of it. And we should keep our eyes on the House and Senate calendars, but especially with the Senate, we definitely need to have conversations with all our senators to encourage them to do the people's work.
Well, Representative Chris Schultz, you are doing the people's work. Thank you for your leadership in the House and for making sure that as the legislature engages in the state's response to COVID-19 and completes its business, that the needs of our communities, and in particular, the most vulnerable members of our communities are put to the forefront. So thank you so much for your work and for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It is the honor of my lifetime. It really is.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. The sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be a nervous Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. All at once, the moon clouded over, we heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on. And we just made it out of the big muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where we'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big fool said to push on. Well, I'm not going to point any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
And the river opens for the righteous. 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 And the river opens for the righteous.
You've been listening to State House Watch Radio's Memorial Day 2020 show with me, Arnie Alpert, and my co-host, Maggie Fogarty, on WNHNLP. You've just heard Waist Deep in the Big Muddy from Pete Seeger and Little Steven, I Am a Patriot. Visit WNHNFM.org for podcasts of all our past shows, as well as The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, Fred Portnoy's Ancient and Modern, and The Lounge Show with Sweet Caroline. Join us again next week, and remember, there's more peace somewhere.
Well, there's a bright side somewhere. There's a bright side somewhere. And I ain't gonna rest until I find